Hello, everybody. Welcome to Lost Explorers. My name is J. David Osborne, and that is Chris Sacknessum. Chris, how are you doing this evening?
David, I'm really grateful for the beautiful weather. It couldn't have been a more splendicious day. I'm trying to feel as good as the weather and all of these little red-headed robins that just appear on my balcony. I did get my taxes done, so I feel kind of good about that. But I actually felt challenged by the weather today to be in as good a frame of mind as it would suggest. But there's been some good musical events of late, feeling pretty good creatively, very weary of school, as I think you might feel. And it's just this transition period now of hoping, well, let's lock into some springtime and not fool around with that weather, freak back to winter again.
It's back to school for me. The kids missed me, which was nice.
Yeah.
We're talking Plot and the Monomyth. I'm dipping
Okay.
their toes into the way that stories work because I've decided that if I'm going to move on to a different job, I'm going to spend the rest of my time talking about things that actually interest me. So the class is going to get very strange and Lost Explorers E very quickly,
Yeah.
because I kind of want my year to play out like a Lynchian in the kind of Mulholland Drive, what the hell did I just watch type of thing, where you sort of start off with a solid, 8 months of normalcy for the most part, quirkiness, but mostly normalcy, and then just end in a bunch. Like today, for example, I started off my class by walking in very seriously, asking everybody how their spring break went and how the week that I was gone went, and then asking them, how many of you have heard of the Lawton Werewolf? Which none of them had. And I told them, well, did you know that in 1971, over 150 people in Lawton reported seeing a 7-foot-tall ape-like creature wearing human clothes that were way too small for it running through town? Scared a group of soldiers on Fort Sill, gave one man a heart attack, and he had to go to the hospital. But all of these people saw it. And the next day, the sheriff's deputy came out and said, well, it's that was kids playing a prank, and everybody who saw it said that was not a prank. That was something different. And none of them had heard about it. And then I told them, well, did you know that when I was in high school, that area on Cache Road that has the Chick-fil-A and the Buffalo Wild Wings was a lot seedier than it is now? And did you know that from 1999 to 2003, there was a serial killer on the loose in that area? He abducted 5 prostitutes from that area. It's a bunch of motels, truck stops, things like that. And he was never caught. And I told them about the Hayter Murder House on Sheridan and I, where a doctor's family was murdered, each one with a gunshot to the head, except for a daughter who was beaten to death with a baseball bat. And I told them the blood stain is still on the ceiling. And by the way, the house is available for sale right now for a steal, 70 grand in this market. So we're getting weird in class, and we're talking about stories.
I
And
love this. I love this. I hope the reaction was as multifaceted as can be. I think that's wonderful, and I think that you need to I think reclaim a little bit of that imaginative subversion of the train as you disembark. I have mixed feelings about this break with teaching, and I understand exactly where you're at. I know everyone understands your decision from a financial point of view, but nonetheless, I think that you will be missed in the ranks of teachers. I don't think that you can escape that calling as easily as changing your job description or filing a different kind of tax return next year. I think you're just going to find a new format for that. But also, I think, to be fair, I think this is one of your big formats for this show. And I think that you've grown an enormous amount in that regard, which I really appreciate. I know listeners do. And I think that the call to teaching is something that we all need to feel and to be part of. One of the things I think that you and I are desperately in agreement with, as most teachers are, is that students are not bringing any kind of co-teaching responsibility to the classroom. It is it doesn't matter about the phones or whatever the mechanisms of distraction are, because those have always been there in some way. I think that we overestimate to some extent how different things are today. They're just simply amplified, purified, with nothing to break the spell. It's very, very difficult, of course. So it is qualitatively different. But the number one thing I see is just the lack of responsibility on the part of younger people to actually be a contributing member of the group, which is what they so desperately claim they want to be. Actually, they want just an authority figure that they can ignore as they do their parents and disappear into their own little world and just assume the world is going to be carrying on bigger than they are when they can complain that they're not big enough, So I get it, man, but I think it's
I
cool that
wish that I could disagree with you, but I can't. I
yeah.
think you're right. I think that touches on some bigger subjects that we're going to get to. I really like where your head is at with without ignoring or downplaying the role of the phones, touching on a bit of a more deep the idea of them not entering into a co-teaching relationship really hits home. I really do think looking back on my year, I feel like as an example, and then we'll get into your band and your aphorism. But an example, I taught a workshop recently with a bunch of guys. It was an outlining workshop. And, these guys, they paid me their money. They were there to rock and roll. And we had four amazing 3 hour plus sessions of me communicating to them my ideas and what they were to do, and them enthusiastically attacking that, and sometimes jumping in to interrupt me to because they're right, they just wanted to have these ideas out. We'd be talking about somebody else's novel, and they would say, I gotta jump in. I gotta say this, 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 and this. And that's what you need. You need somebody who needs to
Dude.
say something so bad that
Yes.
they can't raise their hand. They got to jump in with the conversation and say, you know what? I'm really sorry, but the spirit is moving me and I have something. And you just don't get that from these kids, you know?
No, and I would put it really simply too that I've had many students say to me, in my size classes, which is not unusual, 20 to 26 students, that my classes are the only ones where they know the names of other people.
That's the problem. Yeah.
And I've had
Yeah.
people, I had one, real serious, struggling, classically lost at this moment in time, African American, ghetto warrior who's really trying to get over without really knowing why he's there. He goes, "I don't know how you handle the different names." He goes, "I can't pronounce those names." He goes, "A lot of people can't get my name." And you just seem to rock over it. And I said, "Well, thank you, Pashaun. It's just because I've been doing it a while, but I think that this notion of being together in a group, being a community, having some responsibility for communal energy is the number one problem underlying all of these other issues. And it's why they are having trouble dating, getting laid, building relationships, connecting with family, getting employed. It's just, it really comes down to the ethics and the moral implications of being social, and we'll get to that in a moment. So,
Yeah, we will. We will. We will. So, do you have an aphorism and a band for us today?
okay, my aphorism goes. I have a little bit of background explanation, but I think it stands on its own. You must consider yourself a part of the mystery, the capital M, and for all you know, an essential part, any assumption of insignificance is ironically supreme arrogance. I really think that's a good comeback to a lot of particularly young people today who, you must consider yourself a part of the mystery, and for all you know, an essential part. Any assumption of insignificance is ironically supreme arrogance. And my little support is consider a great earth-moving machine on a jungle island. We've talked about those. I've seen them in the Solomon Islands. One seemingly small and even obscure component isn't consequential, inconsequential. I mean, it could stop the whole show. Think of yourself as a cross between an arrowhead and a key. You'll feel better. I think that we're done with this lack of self-esteem issue of people presenting arrogance, presenting grandiosity, presenting need, and then not also sort of thinking, yeah, look, maybe I am really important to the mystery because I don't have any understanding of the mystery. How can I say I'm not important? Maybe I'm important in ways that I need to, think about and wash my butt and show up on time.
Yeah, what makes you think you're so special that you're not special?
Exactly. Simple as that. And I think young people get that. The better ones do anyway.
I think that's brilliant. I really like the cross between the arrowhead and the key. Because I really do feel like when you are in sync and you're getting the synchronicities of being in sync, you feel like those two things simultaneously. The arrow is the propulsive, you're cutting a path of like a swathe through what you're doing that people can then kind of fall into. And then, of course, the key is self-explanatory. You're unlocking things for other people as the synchronicities are unlocking things in you. And you know as well as I do that it's a state of being that you're either in or out of, and you can physically feel when you go
Yeah.
into it and when you get out of it, right? And so the goal, I think, is to try to be in that state as much as possible. And sometimes to do so, you have to get a little weird, but that's all right.
It is. It is. Absolutely. Okay. Well, I'm glad you dig that and so you certainly understand it. I think it's a message that's really, really relevant for our time. And I think it ties in with what we were speaking about in terms of teaching across the whole education front, and certainly what we're leading into. The band, I think some listeners may have heard of the Penguin Cafe Orchestra, which were a real band that recorded some interesting sort of music, a little bit too eccentric to make the big time. But, back when there was time for more interesting alternative, groups on many fronts. They were a good instrumental group. So this is called the Two-Headed Chicken Orchestra. And it takes its name from when I was in the Guangdong province of China. And there was an unfortunate hormonal mishap at one of the chicken plants. And thousands of chickens were born with two heads. I think I talked about the piglet problem. because these things happen all the time. And some of my young Chinese friends celebrated it as an example of the positive aspects of social media, because they said, rightfully, I think, that this kind of news would have never reached the Western world when they were children. And they were reporting on, I mean, as I think I did say at one episode, what could go wrong with an enormous poultry processing plant immediately adjacent to a sulfuric acid facility? Nothing wrong there.
What could go wrong there?
So the Two-Headed Chicken Orchestra, and their album is titled Mayhem is the Message. They are an officially and classically trained group of based on a string quartet, small horn section, and chamber music instrumentalists. And we have a group like that in Vegas who are enormously talented and underemployed, if not street level at the moment. And they are performing at one of the gas stations, which I walked past to get to class. And I walked past along the way a street guy who's permanently camped out. And the police don't bother him. If you looked at him, you might say why, you'd understand why. He's just built like a brick shit house and can do thousands of push-ups and is being fed by people. He's completely out of his mind, but he does have some talent. He's a schizophrenic freestyle street rapper who calls himself Big Wiener, and he deserves that name. The police have got him to now wear some pants. His first public performance that I saw was Don't Hide the Sausage, and he was certainly not attempting to do that. He most recently had a little sign that said, Stop me if I start making sense. So he is their producer front man, and the collision of these classically trained but now utterly unemployed musicians doing things that today's fans of, Taylor and Beyonce have no idea about musically, just how the depth of capability, the thousands of hours of skills are then matched by an enormous and very frightening, near naked black street performer who has blown all of the doors off the corrupt and decadent ideas of rap music and returned it, well, not even returned it, but installed it back at its most primitive, basic, and also perhaps most clever level.
That's what, whenever you and I talk about rap music, I often think that we might be talking about two different things, because if you've ever gone to YouTube and typed in freestyle rap battles, where two guys just stand across from each other and there's no beat, and they just have to, undress each other with this language, it can get really funny really quickly.
Oh, I
And
do
it's
appreciate that,
amazing.
David. I really do. I mean, I think that you and I are on the same page with this deep down, that what we admire is the linguistic and lyrical and creative energy, rawness, and combative nature, and that it is a kind of strange combat. But I think that looking at the world of what rap became in commercial terms, and its impact on live music, on learning music, on actual instrumentation, I just think that became decadence upon decadence so quickly, and now it's enormously long in the tooth,
Oh, it's super long in the tooth. I do not disagree with that. But you're bringing up some more stuff that I want to talk about with your email. So what is my imaginative challenge so we can get into this meat? We got to get into this meat.
Yes, we do. Okay, so for listeners, we do have some very serious meat coming forward. I pumped out some email notes to David, and he always responds with some real energy. This time it was a real waterfall force of river strength and real engagement. So I thought that we would give him an imaginative challenge on a kind of really fun adventure note to leaven the intensity of what's to follow. But I think knowing David, he'll find ways to harmonize and bring this into some sort of points of resonance. But the idea here, the working title is Gustavo, Subsea Discoverer. We're going to give him the challenge of thinking of his son as the protagonist 20 years into the future or thereabouts. Gus has joined a special aquanautic explorer division of the World Earth Organization. We've given up on the space program by this point. It's just too far to go. There's too much money lost in it. There have been some disasters. Space is just so big, and we've come back around to a ravenous excitement about the Earth and the deep sea. So Gus is established on a submarine going deep into one of the great trenches, like the Mariana Trench, into another kind of outer space. And on this mission, he is one of the first people to witness the discovery of a simply vast, sunken metropolis civilization, unlike anything that we know in pure terms. There are strange residues of North American Pueblo culture, but also some very, very intricate examples that might have come out of ancient Iraq. There's a lot to explore and discover. And he is on the front lines as one of the first witnesses, forming a, at this point, a confidential view of what's going on before any of this information is released to the larger public. And some of the discoveries made are both monumental and also very fine detail, little things that might suggest tremendous degrees of complexity and dimensionality in our thinking about the nature of civilizations at any time in history, but certainly about whoever these people, if that's the right word, whoever they were, and whenever this happened. So, Gustavo, Subsea Discoverer, the pilot episode.
Give me 5 seconds. If I can't find it in 5 seconds, I'll come back. But I want to show you Gustavo's current favorite book. Right back.
Okay.
Did not immediately find it, but it's the Nerdy Baby's Guide to the Ocean.
There you go. There you
He
go,
currently really
man.
likes that one.
See what I think.
All right.
But
Let
you
me
got him
just.
down there deep, lost, separated. He's with a very small contingent of militaristic sort of scientists, kind of super advanced craft, but no one is necessarily hearing or seeing anything that he discovers yet. But he's on the front lines of what may be talked about and released to the public. And what may not be.
I love it. It's good stuff. Also, I made a typo. that I think I'm going to use. So you had said 20 years in the future, and I made a note 20 years in the future, but I made a typo. 20-year sin future.
Ah,
That's
okay.
kind of cool. That's kind of
Yeah, it
cool.
is.
All right, let's get started on this email that Chris sent me. Rapper 50 Cent, age 48, and trying desperately to look like a cartoon version of someone my student's age, says to his 12 million X followers, "It's almost over," as in humanity. This, while he's embroiled in collateral flack from the federal investigations of Puff Diddy for sex trafficking, rape, domestic abuse, drugs, guns, the usual. And where did all the playground sounding names come from? Puff Diddy, Charlemagne the God, Megan Thee Stallion. Strange mix of adolescence, if not childishness, and sexual perversion. Sawfish, improbable creatures that look like they were designed for sheer novelty. They've been going somehow crazy and committing communal suicide in the shallow waters of Florida's beaches. Perhaps a strangely apt metaphor. Weirdly echoed by parents, particularly white parents, in epidemic numbers seeking professionally certified diagnoses of their kids as being autistic, ADHD, clinically depressed, or neurodivergent. Why? In order to secure more time on tests like the SATs and the ACTs. Meanwhile, Harvard, the jewel brand in the Ivy League, and the pressurized holy grail of the test-taking frenzy sees the first drop in applications ever. Anti-Semitism and plagiarism scandals are credited as causes in the decline. The Harvard Corporation, note the term, has also come under legal fire for DEI discriminations against Asians, artificially promoting underqualified African American applicants, while it's been revealed that a disturbing percentage of white admissions are solely legacy based. Children of alumni, faculty, and staff who are in the main unable to compete outside the nepotism advantage. On a broader global scale, scientific experts from many fields debate the concept of the Anthropocene as an umbrella label for the current era epoch. But what no one ignores is that the human impact in question is viewed as entirely destructive. And on perhaps the principle of compounding interest, a great deal of the damage has occurred since the mid-20th century, which mirrors the rise of environmentalism and green ideologies. Say one thing, do another. All right, stick with that. This inventory of dysfunction could go on and on, we know. But like many curious and concerned thinking people today, you and I have talked about the dysfunction often in terms of mass psychosis, a spiritual, psychological vortex disease on the cultural scale. I now wonder if the truth isn't conceptually much simpler. Let's take our sawfish death spiral despair as the emblematic end result of the ambient atmospheric dysfunction. If 50 Cent says the world is, if world doom is at hand, what hope do sawfish have? Let's talk about a marginalized community. What links these other crises and so many more? I'm coming around to viewing the problem as a fundamental collapse slash erosion of morality. Morale, moral. How often do we connect these two notions? Are our problems today really all that complicated? Don't they, in fact, amount to people knowing what the right thing is to do and then not doing it? Each of the above examples from recent news is about a failure of moral conscience and basic decency. Perversion arises from selfishness. Never heard it put that way, but yeah. We can break down or address each of these issues, selected from far too many others, in almost child-level moral terms. Many people, particularly NPR followers, now embody a genuine hatred of humanity for our environmental destruction. Does this mean they're trying to live and consume more sensibly and sensitively? Nope. For the most part, they just complain about what governments and corporations are doing or not. While they go on consuming like it's 1999 or 1979, Ivy League schools, and now so many downstream schools, companies, and government departments know that DEI policies are inherently unfair, divisive, and illogical. Racism in the name of combating racism, victimology in the supposed service of reducing victimization doesn't work, can't work. At the same time, admitting mediocre white candidates because of legacy loyalty is actually an advertisement of total failure in the institution's nurture of academic and intellectual excellence. How is it that legacy applicants are mediocre if Harvard is such an incubator of brilliance and achievement? All of this is just disingenuousness, maneuvering for personal, political, and identity politics gain. It's in the realm of lying and cheating. It's basic morality. Nothing complex or clever about it. Same with parents, especially parents of underachieving white children, pleading to psychologists to designate their kids as special needs. Work the system, milk the system, everybody else is. Could it be that our core problem at this point in history isn't nearly as interesting as technological mass delusion or a giant masquerade festival of psychosis? What if it's just moral sloth, devious self-interest, and everyday spinelessness? What if, as a cultural community, we said, man up and try to be the best, humble, heroic leader in your house and in your neighborhood that you can be? There's honor in that, and you'll live longer. What if we eliminated all legacy advantage across the board? Radical individual meritocracy, as in sports. What if our activism regarding complaints and protest against corporations and governments turned into activism in our own habits and purchasing behaviors? What if we could tell the truth to each other? We need to bring back morality and ethics as essential, completely transcendent of any right conservative frame or leftist rebellion. Hypnosis and hysteria are more exciting than hypocrisy, but mundane hamburger helper level hypocrisy is creating an hypocrisy. No, it's not nearly as cool as a calamity, as a mass hallucination, as a simulated matrix reality. It's really just laziness hard at work. And as to the left's exhaustingly shrill and repeated claim that morality and ethics can only enter in when the playing field is level, that's not a social belief system or a program of coherent public policy. It's a secular religious mania that's so clearly not working as a social program. Only more mania will do. To me, the mania isn't as intriguing as I'd hope. More and more, it just seems purely pathetic.
Well,
Thoughts
thank
about your
you.
thoughts?
Thank you, David. I think that was a very, I appreciate the extended depth of your reading. It always helps me to prosecute my ideas through the filter of your verbal presentation. You're a very fine reader. And I think that you instinctively recognize that I drafted that kind of all in one go, that there really, although there are paragraph breaks, it is essentially one sort of one vision, one argument. But it really comes down to, I think, a pretty major revelation in my life recently, that I think there are certain aspects of really, really important things that, say, you and I are deeply involved with, that there is a kind of popular notion of, well, those are intellectual, educated, questions. Those are for people who are smart. Those don't affect me. And I've been thinking more and more that, well, yes, they do, because they all have moral and ethical implications. And I note that in philosophy departments around the world, morality and ethics courses have either experienced an enormous challenge and decline, or in some cases they are boiling back, depending on a few charismatic professors who have stood firm. And it's very unusual that it's happening. But I think that there isn't something fancy, highbrow, super intelligent about what anything that we've said. We've never made that claim. We try to talk about things that are of interest to us and to our listeners. We try to believe that other people are interested, and so therefore we have listeners. But there's nothing in itself that is overly complex that requires necessarily, some sort of graduate degree in anything. It really comes down to some failings at the basic character fiber. We're not talking the head, we're moving down the body metaphorically into the genital region, the guts, those sorts of areas that determine substance. I do think there is maybe an element of heart, corazón, in this. But there's simply a failing on some very basic levels. And I will share now that I really appreciate you sharing that whole extended note. I've been dealing with some students who are in that challenged, students of color. I mean, all my students are of color, on and on. But I've had some lying to my face about chat. GBT,
Yeah, I have
patriots,
to. Yeah, I have
and
to.
it's just absurd. It's just absurd. They actually don't see themselves as plagiarizing anything. Only one of the five students I've had an issue with really acknowledged the depth of the issue and understood that I was fucking calling her out of the carpet for cheating. I mean, I wasn't slapping these, kids around. I was being delicate. But I think that in the end, what's really going on today is just a moral flabbiness. It's just flaccid. And I think that the right has to take some blame for being overly rigid and posing morality totally in terms of heterosexuality versus homosexuality. Meanwhile, the left wants to let everybody off the hook for everything, and we've got nobody running the show, no adults in the room, no one wanting to be in the room. So maybe we should just bulldoze the school of life.
Okay. And here is the most important part of what you're saying here. And it's what you touch on in your email as well. When people come at this issue, they are coming at it from a partisan ideological stance. Ideology is not morality. It's not. They are two separate things. Ideology fundamentally cannot be morality, although it sometimes dresses up as morality, because ideology necessarily needs to abandon its own principles when it is troubled. It has to, if somebody catches it in a double bind, it has to find a way out, and that means sacrificing its principles. And I think what's unique to your position, and by extension, the Lost Explorers position, is that we are coming for all sides of this, right? So if you're on the right wing and you're like, yeah, the black people should think this way, oh no, we're not done. We're not done. Because we're also talking about white legacy admissions to colleges, okay? The idea that one race or one gender persuasion, however you want to put it, right, is the sole owner of this kind of moral. I really like the word spinelessness that you used, because to me, that's what it keeps seeming like, is completely fallacious. Like, white people are just as guilty of this as black people. In fact, I would argue that any type of person, any type of human being at times in their life will be tempted to kind of totter on that edge of getting rid of their morals in order to pursue material gain. And
Totally.
I've said this over and over and over again. It takes different forms culturally, based on the culture and the history of the culture within a particular milieu, but it's exactly the same one. You know what I mean? Like the DEI, nepotism hire is the welfare queen. They're the same thing, but they're using different systems and different mechanisms to get what they want. AI for me has been completely transracial in terms of who's operating with it.
Yes,
It's all opportunism.
yep, it's
It's all
all, yes, well said, well said.
opportunism and a complete lack of moral fortitude. And the second thing that I really like that you said in this, with that base established that we're coming for everybody, this idea of honesty. Can we just be honest with each other? Like, what are you doing? If you're somebody whose dad invented the plastic wrap on Kraft singles, and now you're a visual artist, that's fine because your art might be good. But I'm not going to lie and pretend that I don't know who you are and how you got to where you are. I don't hold it against you, but I'm also not going to lie. I'm not going to participate in your fiction, you know?
I understand that completely, and I think this needs to really be highlighted as a crucial issue in these culture wars today. There is a very big distinction, and people have tried to make this. I mean, Jordan Peterson tried to. The difference between, respect and following kind of general courtesy and government-compelled speech. I mean, I think there's a huge difference there. And we've got the Secretary of State today putting forward, a whole program of what he describes as simple courtesy, respect, speech. Well, yes, that could be true if you and I were talking about that. But when you put the Secretary of State stamp on it and put that out to all government departments, it's a very different thing. And I think it's really does come back to the kind of street level honesty that someone as deranged as this guy Big Wiener, who lives and performs in behind an abandoned Bank of America on Maryland Parkway, and thinks of himself as being a great entrepreneur like Puff Diddy, Tell him he's not on that level. You'd have to be a faster runner than he is because he'll confront you. But I think that there is just a kind of fundamental collapse of child level honesty, which does,
Oh, yes. No, I'm so sorry to interrupt. That's clicking for me now. The point that you're making about the kind of childishness of rappers' names, also the pedophilia, right? Like trafficking in minors and things like that, this kind of obsession with childhood, and this kind of it makes total sense that like children aren't able to understand the kind of honesty that we're talking about, right? Like what you're really talking is like this is a pre-induction to society level base sub-morality of not being able to tell the truth. So when you have somebody who's named like Diddy or 50 Cent and they're engaging in all this kind of like, have you ever seen the movie Blank Check? Came out in like 95.
I've heard of I that ring. Yeah, I can't bring that to mind in the moment, but I know what you're I know where this is going, I think.
I had it on VHS, and it's about a kid who scams his way into $1 million, which in 95
There's a lot, yeah.
it went a bit further than it does today. But like the whole movie is, what does this kid do with $1 million? So it's like Home Alone, but with money. And he buys robots and bounce houses and macaroni and cheese pyramids and, all this kind of stuff, right? But that's what you kind of see with the rappers too. There's like a fundamental childishness to what they're doing, like enormous, diamond ice cream cones and face tattoos and women that have plastic surgeried themselves into caricatures of what women are supposed to look like. It's all like if you asked a 6-year-old boy, what's the coolest life you could live?
Yeah,
That's
exactly.
the life they're living. But the connection that you're making that's so interesting is that, well, then you apply that to like morality. And to the child, as a father of a 3-year-old right now, the morality is whatever you can get away with.
Well, that says it all. And that is the adult presentation to the younger person. And, I mean, I want to say a couple things like, coming from Oakland, I mean, the pimp culture there was enormously established in an anthropology sort of dream come. I mean, there was an Eldorado Cadillac world there that just, yeah, that had to be dealt with. But that was a long time ago. That was a long time ago. And secondly, I would put forward, okay, let's look at some really great musicians. Muddy Waters, okay, yeah, that's a nickname. I understand that. But Albert King, the king of South Chicago blues guitar, and what a dignified chap he was. I mean, talk about, I don't know, I mean, what masculine virtue did he not have? Sexuality, wisdom, talent, charisma. I mean, he had it all, but he actually could play. That's the thing.
There are rappers called
Whereas,
Lil Baby and Da Baby right now.
I mean, it's just what I see is just this complete erosion of capability. And I might also say that a survey has crossed my desk, which has some interest from John McWhorter, who we both
Oh,
know
yeah. I love
really
John
greatly.
McWhorter. Yeah, he's great.
We're looking into it more. He wants some more time with it. But the potential argument here is that the vocabulary in use by African Americans under the age of 25 has diminished significantly just in the last 5 years, which has a lot of influence on what we're talking about. Because so much of what I think the problem in America really comes down to what's happening with black communities. We're not worried about the Asian communities. They're thriving. We should be worried about every community. We care about everyone. We are in total denial about the Hispanic Latino element. We talked about this, the absence of their presence in Super Bowl advertising terms when they represent the most powerful demographic outside white people. So there are lots of things going on. We've got also the very, very tiny minority influence of the trans community. No one's saying these minorities aren't important. No one's saying that. We're not saying that. I'm not saying that. But we are putting things in perspective, which is the basis of honesty, which is the basis of a view put forward to young people that they're not in sanity conflict with. Another term that Gregory Bateson introduced, which I've gone back to, sanity challenging. There are ways that we can present the world to younger people that so conflict with their immediate perception of things before they even begin processing, before anyone would begin processing. It's just an assault on them. It would be like me calling the wall behind you green when it's clearly not green. I mean, you would have to say, if I insisted on that, you would have to then deal with that. You'd have to say, well, Chris is having some problems. He's trying to make a point, and I'm not sure what it is. He's confusing me. It's just there's something wrong, but you would have to keep dealing with it. If I kept hammering to you that that wall behind you with the, is green, and I think this is what's happening across the board, but we forget it's not just a perceptual level. It is this deep and also immensely simple moral ethical thing. Let's just get away with what we can. Let's just cheat everyone, David. Why don't we do that?
Yeah, why
Why don't
not?
we just cheat everyone? Everyone else is doing it. Come on, man.
And I at this point I will read my email response to you.
Which was outstanding. Yeah, this is a good balance. Good.
I said, this is great. I have more to say on the show, but it is as simple as you lay out. Neither side wants to own this position because it troubles their ideologies. I have suspected this with regard to the book world for quite some time now. I always bring it back to the book world, as I'm
Which
wont
is
to do.
good.
My major point, which didn't gain me any friends on either side of the debate, is that I simply do not believe what you are saying. Not only that, but I do not believe that you believe what you are saying. Social media writers, capitalized, are spineless and desperate to purchase their subjectivity wholesale from those who have come before, which makes sense because they purchased their artistic output in the same way. The way this shakes out in ideology is a complete denial of the role of feedback in shaping the supposed subjectivities they subscribe to. What people believe can never be free from the context within which they exist. In this context, in this case, are those you mentioned, the two sides of the anti-meritocracy coin, DEI and legacy admissions. Imagine what it would look like to reject that particular coin in general. The reason none of these people want to do that is because they've subconsciously or not figured out their place within that paradigm. You mean to tell me that I can be mediocre at everything and still succeed? For many, this is too good to pass up. You've identified something that's been nagging at me, a holistic subjectivity, a way of thinking that is completely alien to the modern man of 2024, an assemblage of principles and beliefs that attempts as best as possible to point true north, and a brutal culling of any beliefs that deviate from the course, no matter how fashionable. Looking forward to this one. And now here we are. So, yeah, so I mean, I really do. We're using a lot of different, types of language here, but at its core, I don't believe that people actually believe what they're saying. And I feel like I have a pretty good sense of that I can kind of tell when people are full of shit and not full of shit. And I just don't believe it,
Well, this is what, I think going back to the wonderful Gregory Bateson is that I really do think that we acknowledge that generally. Where I think that people want to hide is we don't want to deal with the cost of suppressing that realization, that truth. And it brings to mind an interesting when you were here in Vegas, did we end up at the Pepper Mill Lounge?
I don't know if we did. Could you smoke cigarettes in there?
Yeah, you can in the bar. Yeah.
Then maybe, yeah, maybe
Yeah.
so,
The
yeah.
gals, the waitresses wear beautiful evening gowns and their fire pit. No, you'd remember it. It's like a strange Playboy mansion retro thing. For people who haven't been to Vegas, there are other Peppermill lounges, but there's only one, and it is an absolutely essential place to go to. And for anyone who's interested in Black American culture, it is an absolute fantastic place to see incoming groups of weddings, and there are people there that are just amazing. You will see people from Atlanta and Newark, and then you'll see next to like the OJs. Like really famous people. It's a magical meeting ground of culture that shows just how street level democratic Vegas really is. But I was helping some students who were in the film studies program, and they had an idea very much along these lines. I hadn't thought of this in a little bit, but you've brought it full to mind. So the Peppermill Lounge is this rainbow strangeness immediately across the street from Circus Circus, right on the strip. And what they wanted to do was a very sharp juxtaposition. They wanted to show a kind of street fight that erupts amongst people waiting in line, and a guy gets the crap beaten out of him in this fight. And there's one level of civilized response to that, which is difficult and it covers a lot of ground. But essentially, people are really shocked at the violence, and they feel like, well, this guy, was just overwhelmed by, a bigger guy. And it's civilized, but kind of ugly too. In the second response, it's entirely imaginative in a very dark way. And the loser is not only sort of there broken and bleeding, he's set upon by the whole crowd and absolutely destroyed physically. It's a setup, it's not real. This is a film, it's a fun film. Fun. But the difference is, well, what is the difference actually? I remember watching the I didn't see the final finished version of it, and I need to chase this up to see what happened to it. But I remembered seeing the direct confrontation of those scenes and being very, very confused, as the two young filmmakers, writers wanted me to be, But I thought, wow, here is this mercy and forgiveness. Well, you don't have to be the biggest, toughest guy, you. And then the other one is, well, yeah, you do, and if you're not, well, we're going to beat you into the pavement till your blood runs down the drain. It was very, very interesting. And I think that we, as a civilization, if you want to use that word, which I don't think we're, I mean, really the bottom line is we don't deserve that term anymore. We're really in conflict with the individual level of fortitude, that word that you used, to tie back to our teaching metaphor of the student co-teacher. We don't know what fortitude individuals need to bring to any group situation for morality at large to exist. All we talk about in terms of morality is really some very crude culture war things of, I don't know, it just seems that's a kind of narrow, kind of, that's a pathetically narrow approach to the idea of morality and ethics, which you and I are talking about in much broader terms. Cheating, honesty, basically living true to perception and accepting other possible perceptions in the moment before ideology, which is the point that you made. I think that was a really, really essential point, because so many people, they just jump straight to ideology.
The biggest word that comes to mind that is applicable across the board is corruption. It's corruption because the first, group of people that comes to mind when I think of corruption is the police. You always think of corrupt cops. Well, it's because cops had a duty that they were supposed to do. And it's very dramatically compelling to us that these people who are supposed to be keeping everyone else safe might be tempted by quick money, status, a new boat, whatever. But it's corruption,
Oh,
right?
totally.
You know what I mean?
I mean, I think you and I have nothing but support, Jen. I mean, almost all of the students that we're dealing with, I'm dealing with, are students of color. I've had great experience. I do think my one perception there is I think that the subject in America is far overblown relative to the number of people actually involved. I
Do you see
think
the thing that I sent you, the baizu?
yeah.
Baizu, what Chinese call us, baizu. So the Chinese have this term called baizu, and it's an American leftist that uses their particular, group, kind of subcategory, right? Like whoever you might be, like it's all this stuff that that we all know is happening, and whether or not you want to admit it is kind of up to you. But the Chinese, being separate from us, see it clearly and have a word for it. It's called baizu. And I really like baizu.
Wayne, all of this is really just so fundamentally adolescent, which ties back into the rappers' names and just this paradigm of which is what Europeans and the Asian world thinks of us as America trapped forever in high school, which is not growing up. There's no adults in the room. No one wants to grow up. The worst thing that could be said of you is that you look old or that you sound old. Lisa and I got into this thing the other night on the phone, and she said, oh, we really sound old, when we said it. And I said, well, to whom? I mean, to younger people, right? And she goes, well, yeah. I said, well, you know what, honey? Everything we say
Is
sounds
gonna
old.
sound old because we are old.
I mean, it's like, why we're, and do we care? They can't even find their own buttholes to wipe themselves. A lot of them, they're desperately in need of a great deal of support just to sort of be able to function. And they're certainly not going to be able to lead the country. Who cares what they think? I think this is the larger thing. We've got some enormous generational divides that we have to heal. And I hate to say this, I think a lot of that is falling going to fall on your demographic. Because you still have 36 summers left,
I do. I do.
which is not as many as the Gen Zers, but the leadership is going to have to kick in, civic leadership, school board leadership, community home, all of those things that are the glue that holds together communities despite tornadoes. If we really don't see that from your generation in the next 5 to 10 years, it's all over Red Rover. It really is.
And maybe we will. Maybe we'll start talking about this some more. I mean, we're talking about it here, and I mean, I don't know how else you're really supposed to have this conversation other than, you have two sides to a lot of these issues, and neither one seems to budge. And I kind of feel like you and I are in the middle,
And I think that we're both really united in a sense of being under the roof line of our families and our own self, that we can't look to these ideological frames for guidance. They're not gods, they're not divinity figures. I read an interesting piece about how ideologies become the new gods of our time. That you have to sort of, kowtow to them, you have to sort of believe in them. And they will support you. But of course, they don't. They don't support us in terms of paying our bills and leading our children forward. It goes back to this very basic level of personal morality and ethics. And I would like to touch on one of the things that you did read aloud from my notes, which I think is the encouraging and also the simplifying term. The question of morale, which is really important. We want good morale. We want good morale personally. We want it in our marriages and love relationships. We want it in our families. Morale is how we feel, our desire to live, our desire to share, and it's health. It's a kind of health. And moral. I mean, how many people really make that connection? I mean, it's not acting moral for the sake of, not having stones thrown at you or conforming. No, there's a kind of morality that makes you feel good because you've done the right thing. And it's good for morale. You know, you've got your feet underneath you. You can look people in the eye and you go, no, look, I'm sorry if you disagree, but this is something important to me. I feel like I'm clean and cool and good. I'm not cheating anyone. I got my taxes in. I'm feeling like I'm carrying the ball, you know?
Carrying the ball is a good way to put it. That's a good way to put it. Yeah, and I think that what I would like to talk about next time is this kind of way forward and what a kind of leader like that might look like.
That's good.
Because I do think that I'm picturing these two, frothing at the mouths sides of, say, the trans debate, right? And being a kind of person who walks in and says, okay, look, we need to let them live the way they want to because they can, because they're adults and they're allowed to do whatever they want to do, as long as it's not hurting anybody. And as far as I can tell, it's not hurting me. So leave them alone. But on the opposite end of things, like, don't compel people to say things that are not true, also, right?
Exactly. I mean, that's where
So
it
it's
does
like,
need to hurt people. Yes.
right.
Yeah.
So you can exist, but then you can't turn around and go like, and now you have to call me this. Wait, hold on. Now all of a sudden, now you're impinging on other people. Those people are allowed to call, like, people can call me whatever they want. I don't understand. Like, I found this out by being an adult for almost, what, 20 years now? Like, people can call me and think whatever they want about me. And I just have to kind of let that slide. Like, they can look at me and think, like, that guy looks smug, or he looks ugly, or whatever. And they can say those things, and I can't do anything about that. That's what other people think. That's not my, that's not my purview to stop them from doing that. And so it's like, because I feel like anytime this argument starts to get like heated on either side, right? You have one side coming out and being like, we have to kill him, we have to get rid of him. And it's like, no, chill. But then the other side comes out and says, yeah, and if they don't acknowledge me for who I am exactly as I say I am, that's as good as killing me. And it's like, well, calm down. No, that's not it either.
Yeah,
You know what I mean?
right.
Like, can we just agree that you guys think it's weird, they think it's okay, and that's it?
Or maybe could we say both sides, you're both bullies, and we're not going to put up with any kind of bullying
Yeah,
behavior.
don't bully, stop bullying people.
Yeah.
Because it feels weird. If I was like, Chris, right now, I want you to tell me that you love me. Say the words, Chris. Say, like, you'd be like, well, David, you're my friend, and maybe I do love you, but if you're being weird, making me say that I love you in front of all these people. And I was like, you fucking bigot. How dare you? Do you not love me? Do you want me dead? Is that what it is? Well, then
Oh
say it right now. You see what I'm saying?
no.
Like, it's weird. It's weird to put people in that position. So that side needs to stop doing that too. Just stop. Let
Stop
them
it.
think what they think.
What that really is in a fundamental mental health situation, and no one can get past this because no one's revising the mental health statute so completely. That's paranoia. That is deep-seated paranoia of overvalue self and a need to arrange the world around that. You know, it's a manipulative, it's even worse than bullying because bullying is just sort of crude and coarse and it really, it requires someone to be foolish enough to be victimized by that. But this other thing is a relentless pressure of Well, if you don't, this means X about you. No,
Mm-hmm.
it's not. It means Y about the presenter of that idea. It means a absolute de facto psychosis. That's really what's going on. And if you want to validate other people's psychoses, well, sometimes we choose to do that. We can. We can.
Oh, I do all the time. Yeah, there's no problem with that. Use judiciously, like when you
Yeah.
want to. Yeah. I mean the crackhead on the corner, if he wants to tell me he's Jesus, all right. Yeah, it's cool. I'll go with it.
But then again, Big Wiener says, stop me when I start making sense, And I love that little twist on that. If you're really being honest with me and dealing with me as this completely psychotic, naked, black, crazy guy who scares you, then you'll actually say, wait a minute, pal, put on some pants, and actually, you might have some intelligence and maybe think of cleaning up and not sleeping in that ratty sleeping bag. And why aren't you a recording producer? Just a thought.
Yep. So with my imaginative challenge today, I was
Yeah, take us
so
under
into the
Steve.
combo. I was into the combo, so it's a bit more thin than usual, but here we go. Gus has gone deeper than anyone has ever gone before, and as he goes deeper, he begins to notice a strange primordial origination of our architecture. So he's seeing rusted ziggurats and step pyramids, Quetzalcoatls dueling with Gothic gargoyles. But
Ugh.
that's when he notices the non-Euclidean geometry that Lovecraft spoke about. Tunnels that look long from one angle but short from another, and vice versa. Long cylindrical roads that seem to invite the skyscrapers to swirl around them in a kind of hypnotic pinwheel fashion. And then suddenly, Gustavo begins to notice the creatures that live there, and it's these creatures, more so than the geometry, that is the missing link here. They are half human, half squid creatures that he begins to realize moved the city on their own. It didn't go missing, it
Oh.
was relocated. The non-Euclidean geometry begins to make sense because if you can make a tunnel seem long from the outside, but actually short in terms of travel, you might be able to brave these distances and actually exist at the bottom of the ocean without the pressure destroying you. And so they communicate to him psychically, and Gus's big conundrum is whether or not he tells his teammates what he's seen. But I think that's interesting to kind of move it away from the architecture and, these kind of relics of what he's seeing into the idea that they are actual beings that have chosen to move there. Because I don't think I've ever heard that as an Atlantean, kind of theory, right? Atlantis was always destroyed.
Yes,
But what if Atlantis was
static.
what if it
Yes.
was moved intentionally?
Yes. Oh, I love that thinking, David. That's an Atlantean idea. We talked about what Atlantean thinking is, and I have some good examples coming up for next show. I think that's a beautiful demonstration off the cuff of what that means, of really clearing some very static things. Oh, like the city sinks, yeah. It does look cool underwater, the pillars. They always look sort of like a Greek, temple that's shrunk down into under the sea. Yes. But no, I think what you raised is a really, really important, interesting idea. And for listeners, this is a good example of where these imaginative challenges go to, really. It's not some sort of enormous, super blown out way, revision of premise. It's sometimes the small things, apparently small things, that really show a phenomenal shift in paradigm, which is what we're really striving for in the show. I think that's lovely, Deb. There was also some just beautiful poetic writing. There was some true freestyle sort of rap leading up to that. So I would watch Gustavo Subsea Discoverer, the second episode, and I would be hooked, I think. I
Hell
think
yeah.
beautiful job.
Thank you. Yeah, I appreciate that. Do you have a tool and a tip for us today?
I do, and on that sort of, I think you put forward a really, really beautiful. All the responses to the imaginative challenges are interesting, but I think that was a really important one, and I think this notion will kind of harmonize with that. It's another take on a tool that we often look at, but I'll read the whole sort of little setup that I just dictated very quickly because it shows where the idea came from. I've never played marbles. I owned a set once in a soft purple Royal Crown bag. Wouldn't know how to play. I've never used the word eleemosynary in an actual sentence. That was one of David's words from last time. Very strange word. I've never seen the musical Bye Bye Birdie in any form. Huge, big, successful thing when I was a kid. Never seen it. I've never eaten pheasant under glass or baked Alaska. I've never driven a Cadillac or received a telegram. Yet it's interesting. Somehow, in the process of inventory, thinking of these nevers, they seem less remote, as if savored with or by some unknown sense. So, what I came to out of just dictating that really in the spontaneity of the moment, there is a weird power to inventory. And you and I have talked about this. It seems like such a basic quartermasterly skill. And it is the basis of brainstorming and forming an outline for writers in various different ways. I don't think people actually learn how to do an inventory very well. I think you do need to have a little bit of an OCD sort of edge to do it well. I think you need to be curious. I think there's a lot of art to it. But I think there is a strange cutting edge where you feel like you can inventory the things that you, for instance, in this case, the things I've never done, and therefore probably never will. You know, I mean, I love looking at Cadillacs, all vintage Cadillacs. I don't really care if I ever, you know, I really don't care to drive one. Really, I'm not going to go out of my way, but I have a lot of photographs of them. I think in, you know, there was a vintage of them in the 50s and 60s that I thought were really beautiful. I don't really care about the current versions. I don't care about baked Alaska. You know, I really don't. I don't care about caviar. There's a lot of stuff, you know. But the idea is that the inventory as a category tool, as a conceptual tool, gives us power over things that we can't do, don't want to do, may never do. And that is really important. I think that really is a very handy tool. On the other hand, and this is where I think it ties back to our theme of ethics and morality on a really baseline level, not these big ideological levels or, you know, sexual levels, or it's just truthfulness. It also can give us an illusion of knowing and dealing with things that we don't know. That's its purpose to some extent. And that ties back into earlier discussions we had about the memory palace, structures of knowing and epistemological certainty versus the swamp, all the things that we don't know. And we do need ways to process that. So stay honest with the inventory as a tool because it is very powerful. Use it to maybe sort of domesticate things that you don't know in a good way, but don't think that you do know them because you've inventoried them.
Domesticating things that you don't know. That's so fucking cool.
Thank you.
Domesticating things that you don't know is a killer, killer, killer turn of phrase. I love that.
Thank
I'm
you.
thinking,
All right.
just on a level of, as a fan of action movies, I don't know anything about guns to that extent. I have one. I can shoot it, but I'm not a autist about guns or or really any kind of combat. I like watching it in a kind of balletic John Wick, Hong Kong, Jackie Chan style,
Sure.
but I don't fight that way. If we're fighting, I'm trying to fucking rip your eyeball out. I'm
It's
not
not
doing
this.
this dance. It's not this cool dance,
No.
but I keep an inventory of it, and I
Yeah.
might kind of on a certain level understand it, but practically, it's not me, dude. It's not me. But I've domesticated that. That's such a cool idea.
I'm glad you like that. And I think that that ties in with my tip, because I think there is a lot of this that we've derived from media world, the dream world of media. And as that's just grown in intensity and complexity and sophistication, I just happened to be watching a little segment of an original Outer Limits episode, and I accidentally just took a photograph of it, just this kind of nice sort of blur. And then I thought, because we have talked about the philosophy of photography and the philosophy of media and the dreaming world that has been imposed on us, that this is where the matrix comes from. And it occurred to me to ask the question, do I look at that black and white moment, and it's blurred, the two characters are crossing over, it's kind of a cool moment. Do I think of that in terms of the color that's absent? And I thought, no, I don't. I fundamentally, psychologically don't. I absolutely accept that in terms of its black and whiteness, as if that is the world therein created. So my tip is, I think, to be a little bit more attuned to those moments that we absolutely just accept on their own terms, without any kind of, because we're always about this ideology, always about this presentation of our own values and shit. I don't think that we're actually all that strong for that. I think we're oftentimes just overwhelmed very quickly and subtly. We just go,
That's
yeah.
so interesting. Yeah, I don't think ever watching a black and white movie have I ever wondered what color things were.
Yep.
Ever.
No.
Ever. It's
We
black
just
and
don't.
white. It's black and white. It's shades of gray.
We're rhetorically completely sold. Totally.
How
Totally.
weird is that?
It is weird. It's deeply weird. It is profoundly weird, and it is the key to it. You know what it is? It's like when you're paddling along and you see a little sort of tributary up, and you think, that's maybe kind of could be a big river. That could be a really, really big. And the river that I think I'm in, no. It's aerial view, and it looks very different.
That's very interesting. Have you been dreaming?
I have, and I had a really an interesting collision. I had a very, very basic memory of some friends who were about 20 years older than my main wife and I in Australia. And they were very, very generous people. They had us over often on the weekends. And they really fed us, and there was a lot of alcohol. And that was my first recollection, how kind of just assumed that was. But I also remember how hospitable they were, their hot tub, their garden, the whole. And I thought, all of that seems gone now. Maybe the alcohol, it's good that it's gone. That was, yeah, that was just intense. I don't know how we dealt with all that. But also the hospitality. So I had that anchor point of something extremely realistic and adult. And then I moved to something that was very Twilight Zone and sort of Borgesian. In a secondhand store, a very, very odd owner kind of your classic Twilight Zone Outer Limits character actor suggested I might be interested in this implement, this item. And at first, I wasn't sure what he was talking about. When I became aware of it, and that is the right way to put it, it was a very straightforward cone of extremely thin glass that was on the one hand like crystal, and on the other hand like a plastic. It was almost too thin to really exist and be visible. And there was a little volcanic divot at the top, and placed in it was a kind of a golf ball-like thing that was really like a wasp's nest. You know how they are sort of papery and kind of not real? And it was sort of like a wasp trying to make a golf ball. But only that placed on the top made it visible. And the owner of the shop said, if you lose the ball, you won't be able to find it again. And he said, be careful what you think of around it. And I was really intrigued. I thought, well, this is sort of emblematic artifact of another world. And so I brought it home, and I would often misplace it. It seemed like the light only would find it, even when the golf ball was in place. But when I carried the golf ball around, I couldn't find it at all. Except suddenly I would think of something, and there it would be. And one time I had one of my musician friends over, and I said, check this out. And he's going, what? And then he goes, oh, wow, where did you get that red toy ambulance? That must be worth a fortune. They don't make those kinds of toys anymore. And I said, what do you mean? And then I saw it too. And I said, well, I'm not sure where we're seeing. He goes, I don't know where I'm seeing that either. And I said, oh, I'm going to put the ball back in the cone. And then we saw the cone for a moment, and then no more. And it was this strange, emblematic door of possibility that some people just had no clue about at all. I don't even see it. I don't know what you're talking about. And I would learn to not even share it with them. Whereas someone else like you, I would go, David, let's just come over and sit by it. And we'll
Check out the
see what we
cone.
think of. And where does this thing that we think of live? Do we actually think of it as being physical, like this little toy metal ambulance, or whatever? And it was a really, really lovely little thing that just it seemed real enough to handle the mystery. Because it obviously doesn't make any sense in any sort of,
I
realistic.
think it makes total sense. I hear that, and that's what ideas are. That's the
Yes.
entirety of communication wrapped up in a dream. Be careful what you think around it.
Nice.
A kind of
I
shared
like that.
agreement. I mean, I'm
Okay.
seeing this as like this, especially considering what we've talked about in this episode and where your head has been at. That dream makes total sense to me. Like,
Well, I'm glad you think
who's going to
so.
be
You
there with
just
you when you put the golf ball on the co on the volcanic divot of this cone, you know? I mean, and what are you going to agree to see? It's about agreement.
that's the thing. Okay. Well, I'm glad that that makes the sense. See, but this is exactly what this strange artifact demonstrates is that you and I have a rapport that I would feel comfortable sharing it with you because there were other people that I learned just not even to mention it
Don't
to.
do it. Yeah, don't do it. I mean, I've learned that in my life too. There are some things just don't say. Just don't
Don't
bring up.
show them the cone,
Don't bring them to the cone. They're not ready for the
Oh, well,
Oh,
that's
it's
really good. And I did,
good
I
title for the episode too. Not ready for the cone.
And I did send you a little a kind of a spoken word musical piece on
Okay.
called The House. I think
Okay.
it's something that it ties in with the poetics of space and a whole lot of dream stuff that we've talked about. So it's short. It's not one of my longer pieces, but I think it's maybe kind of a fun way to end this. But David, as always, you bring, ideas into focus. I think that, this is what we're trying to be for each other. Really lenses that sharpen perspective and give
I think so.
reassurance,
I think so. I really look forward to these every week, and I would encourage people, as this is one of our more difficult episodes, we haven't cut anything out of it. We're just going to present it as is. Just keep in mind that Chris and I, are operating on a certain kind of frequency. And so if at any point during this episode you felt troubled, good. Good.
And know that the trouble is about healing and challenge and moving forward. I mean, I think that we have no apologies for our positions. We also aren't rigidly fixed in that position. We shift and move forward all the time. But I think if we're not able to present some pretty essential questions about the nature of asking questions, which is what ethics hinges on, then we're really, I don't know why society can move forward.
I really think you presented a very troubling question in the past 2 hours. And we've talked about a lot of cool stuff, but this is one that's going to stick with me, which is why aren't there any trans men in men's sports? Just think about that for a second.
It is odd. I mean, I think it's. I mean, I'm sure there's got to be some examples of, but certainly not reaching the level of competitive success.
I don't think there are. In what? In soccer, maybe? Could be.
Not
Maybe.
combat sports.
Not combat sports, not football, not certainly not basketball, not baseball. Why are there no trans men in men's sports?
Well, it is a conundrum, and we
It's a
haven't
tough one.
embarked on success.
And I think as gentle and even-handed as this episode has been, I really do think that that's a kind of a devastating question that I've never thought of before.
Okay, well, we're in favor of big questions. We want people to think, and to also feel comfortable with. Having a moment of going, wow, I'm not sure what to think about that. That's all right too. This is where the anxiety starts, and I think this is where the ethical cowardice starts, is that people feel they need an instant answer for everything, And it's, oh, that's just not how things work,
No, just be yourself. Be yourself. It's cool. We'll like you. People will like you, no matter who you choose to be. I mean, whatever brought you to whatever stage of life you're at is so complex. And so, I'm sure if you put it into an artistic work, it would be very beautiful. And Chris and I appreciate that. And we like weirdos. That's what people don't understand, is that like we like weird people. You like Big Wiener because he's a freaking weirdo.
he's certainly in a category all his own. And
But
I
if
really
he told you that he
respect
was the
that.
president of the United States, you'd be like, all right, man. Yeah, if you want to. Sure.
Yeah, no, see, that would be unethical of him. But if he said he was the master DJ god of that section of Maryland Parkway, I would go, you're absolutely right, you
You're
are.
that. You are that.
You are that. You are that 110%. Truth,
Crit.
truth is what we seek, really. I think that's the hardest thing to accept.
It is, Chris. I appreciate you more than you could know, but I'm signing off for the night.
Okay, David. Well, thank you so much. Thank you, listeners. Always a pleasure. Always a learning experience, which is not something I can say about everything. So thank you, David. And I do love you, by the way. In
Yeah.
my way, I do. I more than I can say.
I
Okay.
love you too.
All right. Take care, everyone. Be safe. We'll be back with more next time.